This is a CBC podcast. Keep track of your game with CBC Sports. With headlines, clips, schedules, and news, our sports portal will tell you what you missed and what not to miss. Check it out at cbc.ca/sports.
I'm Paul Kennedy. Welcome to Ideas. Human beings are born image makers and image enjoyers, now and in our ancient past. 16,000 years ago, our ancestors painted pictures of galloping wildlife on the walls of caves in southern France. They carved plump fertility statues in Austria and etched intricate carvings on axe handles in New Guinea. And those are just examples of visual art making. But art can take a huge variety of forms, which echo and imitate the dance of life. From the delicate movements of a Japanese tea ceremony to the deafening clamor of a rock concert. From the storytelling of the Bible or the Iliad to the novels of Margaret Atwood and the space operas of Star Wars. Human beings have always created a world of artful sights, sounds, and experiences. We take it for granted. But it's often not quite clear why we do it. Surround ourselves with images and art. Enter Dennis Dutton. Dennis Dutton teaches the philosophy of art at the University of Canterbury in New Zealand. In a quest for some answers, Dennis Dutton has turned to evolutionary psychology to find out how and why art evolved. The result is his book, The Art Instinct: Beauty, Pleasure, and Human Evolution. Dennis Dutton graciously came into a studio halfway around the world in Christchurch, New Zealand, to talk about his consuming interest. I began our conversation by asking him what drew him, a critic and a philosopher, to write about art from the standpoint of evolution.
Well, I suppose, really, if I think back on the history of my interest in this problem, I don't come to it from science necessarily, or from even philosophy. I come to it from being bedeviled through my career by aesthetic questions. I mean, what really is the source of the love of the arts? Why do we value the arts so much? Why do, for example, in most industrial democracies these days, these are British figures that I'm quoting, but I think they'd apply to Canada or the U.S., 6% of all waking life of adults is spent enjoying fictions, getting deep pleasure from watching soap operas, reading bodice rippers, reading great classics of fiction, going to movies, going to plays. 6% of all waking life. Highly pleasurable, it calls out for some kind of explanation. So all of the standard questions of philosophical aesthetics, it seems to me, are ones I've been wanting to answer through my career, and I do think evolutionary psychology throws light on these questions. It doesn't have all the answers. I don't have all the answers, but I think it's just fascinating to see how the new developments in biological science, and evolutionary psychology throw light on the most important questions about the sources of our love of the arts, the pleasure the arts give us, and why they're so important in our lives.
You've just given us a very precise, concise description of what you do, actually, in the entire book. So I guess I then ask the next question, which would be, what does then evolutionary science tell us about art and instinct, or the art instinct, as you call it?
Well, I mean, I think even before that, maybe a question to ask is, why does evolutionary science count as relevant to this at all? And I think there are three things about the arts that point us in the direction of evolution. The first is that the arts give people intense pleasure. Anything that gives people intense pleasure, whether it's, being around their children and playing with their children, eating sweet and fatty food, sex, anything that gives people intense pleasure probably points to some kind of an evolutionary adaptation. It's pleasurable because it was good for survival and procreation in the past. The next thing is universality. The arts are universal. They are not the product of one particular kind of culture. They're not an invention of modern technologies. So far as we know, the arts go back far beyond the caves of Lascaux and Chauvet 20 or 30,000 years ago. I mean, people must have been doing things for which there's no record, even back into prehistory, making jokes, using ornamented language, singing, or it might have seemed like howling to us. But that came from somewhere. People were actually using fictions for entertainment in the prehistoric caves, in the Pleistocene. And then spontaneity. The arts spontaneously arise in cultures around the world. They spontaneously arise even in children's play. Artistic sensibilities, skill sensibilities, entertainment sensibilities. These three things, pleasure, universality, and spontaneity, point towards some kind of an evolutionary explanation that's required for the arts.
If that's such an obvious connection, why has no one done it before you did?
Well, because we've lived in an atmosphere of ideology for the last 50 years where it simply has not been fashionable, intellectually acceptable to raise these questions. Art, particularly among academics since the Second World War, has been seen as socially constructed. With all arts coming out of local cultures, you can't really understand them from the standpoint of foreign cultures, not deeply or seriously. So we can't understand Indian music. We can't understand New Guinea carving. We couldn't understand the great arts of China or Aboriginal art without some kind of explanation, and even then we wouldn't get it in the way that the local culture would get it. So this idea is that the arts have been treated as though they're specifically unique to local cultures rather than being open to all of us as human beings. Well, I think they are open to all of us, and I think that what we ought to do is just face the most obvious facts. And that is that the Japanese prints are loved in Brazil, that the Chinese adore Shakespeare, that Beethoven is loved by the Koreans and by the Japanese. In fact, Hollywood movies, you know, go around the world. We can appreciate the arts of other cultures because they speak at a level that's deeper than culture, and it's getting underneath culture that I'm interested in this book. I'm sure not denying the extreme importance of culture. Art, like language, always comes through some kind of cultural medium everywhere in the world. But underneath it are basic structures of our humanity which impel us to make it, to create it, and to love it. And that's what I'm after.
What's so interesting, though, is that it is, in a sense, a declaration of independence for art, capital A, art. And it's a declaration which is written, in a sense, in scientific language. And I find that really fascinating. It's sort of a real tension there that is something that you spin out in the book.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I suppose it's true. It is a declaration of independence. Not to take art and to reduce it to some simplified scientific formula. I think that's been tried in the past and it doesn't work. But to respect the richness and the great elaborative, gorgeous, over-the-top characteristics of all of the arts around the world, but to see them as, in their greatness, coming out of something deeper, which is, in a way, independent of culture, but at the same time, I must say from my standpoint, also independent of these bloody academic dogmas that have pulled us down for 40 years from post-structuralism, from deconstructionism, these ideologies that are taught in English departments now around the world, jargon-ridden and full of all sorts of political tendentiousness. We've got to get away from that kind of academic theorizing and get down to something which I think is deeper and respects the pleasure that the arts give us. I mean, that's one of the things you go into to many humanities departments in universities, and you can read all the stuff they assign to their students, and the one thing that's missing from that is any recognition that we get intense pleasure from reading Jane Austen. She just delights us. That Beethoven just, you know, moves us. Wow, he just sends us out into outer space, our minds, if we listen to this great music. We've got to get back to respecting and wanting to understand the roots of artistic pleasure. And that doesn't come from all the kind of jargonized dogmas that we're taught at universities.
Okay, the book is called Art, The Art Instinct, Beauty, Pleasure, and Human Evolution. And what does evolutionary science tell us about the art instinct?
Well, I think what it tells us is that there are ways of making sense of the arts as a natural category, not a socially constructed, unnatural category on top of things that are natural. But I think that the arts are as natural, that is to say, as I said earlier, spontaneously arising in cultures around the world. They're as natural as the idea of the family, of, you know, people closely associated, blood relations living together and caring for each other, as human sociality. They're as natural as sex. They're as natural as the ways in which people modify their local foods and turn them into cuisines. These are very old human proclivities, and it's not so much that we start from evolution, and it's not so much as my book starts from evolution and moves from evolution to the modern arts. That's why, unlike other books that have been maybe written about this kind of subject, people will often start with the ancient caves and the few carvings that are left in Europe and elsewhere, and move from these upper Paleolithic carvings, these late Pleistocene carvings, into the modern arts. I don't do that. As a philosopher and an aesthetician, I'm looking at the structure of the arts today. I'm looking at them in terms of the way in which they make themselves manifest across cultures, the problems of understanding them, and I'm trying to reverse engineer where they would have come from, that is to say, what would have been the case in the Pleistocene to account for our present tastes and our present interests. I mean, take something like calendars across the world tend to have certain kinds of landscapes. And you will find these landscapes everywhere. You'll find them, of course, on chocolate boxes, on greeting cards. You'll find them hanging in people's living rooms. And you'll find them even in countries that don't have that as their local kind of landscape. Komar and Melamed, the artists, did a poll back in the 1990s involving trying to find out people's tastes across the world in 10 different cultures. And what they found was that people across the world have as their number one favorite kind of painting landscape painting. But not just landscape painting of a particular kind, where you have copses of trees and open areas, where you have a sort of a raised vantage point, where there's water, there's evidence of animals, there are blue mountains in the distance, and some kind of a path that goes toward those mountains. Well, it turns out to be a pretty good scientific literature, especially pioneered by a few Americans and Germans, on landscape preferences. Landscape tastes are universal. And what we have to do is to see and to understand that it's not cultures that give people these tastes in landscapes. Rather, these are Pleistocene tastes. These are tastes for the kinds of landscapes which were the most survivable for us, the most favorable for us in the Pleistocene. Once you understand that, the prevalence of these beautiful landscape pictures everywhere all of a sudden begins to make sense. You can make sense of it in terms of what would have been adaptively advantageous in the Pleistocene. I mean, I do love the whole landscape idea, because one of the things that's characteristic of these beautiful blue landscapes that people love everywhere is that they'll so often have some kind of a road or a clearing, or it may be a seashore with a beach that goes into the distance that you could follow, something that kind of way-following, that you could take that road. And that's so important because our ancestors are the ones who loved the idea of going down that road. Their genes are ours, in a way, and that's why we love to look at that road, because our ancestors are the ones who took the road.
I actually always loved those studies, because the description they gave, that you just gave us, of a landscape with water and trees and a mountain, it always felt like Canada to me for some reason. So I thought the whole world loved this place.
It's funny that you should say that, because I was having all sorts of Canadian pictures just flashing through my mind as I was describing it to him, thinking, yes, it's true. That is Canada. And think of all the Europeans who came to Canada because they saw pictures like that and they said, I want to go there.
Not just Europeans. In fact, Japanese people come to to Banff in the thousands. So it again buttresses your argument. This is cross-cultural.
It is cross-cultural. It shows in Japanese art the same kind of landscape type show in Japanese art and in Chinese art. You find it everywhere. And, of course, that was the great thing which stymied the Komar and Melamed interpreters, that people in Kenya and in parts of the world that didn't even have those kinds of landscapes chose those as their favorite kind of calendars and their favorite kind of landscape pictures. So how do you explain that if local conditions and local culture is causing people to have certain tastes? And the answer that was given by the other side, by my opposition on this, was to say that the calendar industry has sort of conspired to brainwash people to like these kind of landscapes. That's why you have them preferred, for example, by people in Kenya. And I think that's just simply risible. That's just absurd. The calendar industry is not a conspiracy. The calendar industry is actually worldwide trying to cater to people's tastes, and those are Pleistocene tastes. That's what we have. That's one small example, but we can extend that into fiction. We can extend it into the kinds of things that people like in fiction, the reason they like fiction in the first place. We can extend it, I think, into music, though that's a difficult one for me because it's hard to see much in the way of a direct adaptive advantage for music. Indirectly, though, it does seem to be there. And dance and all of the other arts. These arts have aspects which increased human survival in the past and give us intense pleasure today.
Those are the kinds of examples that really are run all the way through the book, and it's a smorgasbord of artistic examples that anyone who is well-cultured will be able to read the book and, I guess, sort of go off in their minds in all kinds of tangential directions with wonderful support, again, for your theory on art being something really powerful and really universal. The book, though, I want to go back to the book is a book which talks about the insights that recent advancements in the fields of evolutionary science, those insights, how they could be applied to art and art instinct. I want to get you to define a couple things from evolutionary science before we start. One is natural selection. What does it mean?
Natural selection is a process that explains evolution. I mean, Darwin didn't come up with the idea of evolution. That's an old idea which goes back before Darwin. Darwin's great genius was in The Origin of Species, to come up with the idea of a mechanism that explains natural selection, and that is random mutation and selective retention. Species randomly sort of mutate here and there, and the things that add and aid survival are the things that survive. So that's if you look at why it is that your body has fingernails, hair, why you have a pancreas, a heart, a respiratory system, why your blood is composed in the way that it is, it actually is because all of these involve a history of innumerable random mutations in us and the species that preceded us, and selective retention for the things that increase survival. So that's natural selection, and it explains not only the construction of the human body, but it explains aspects of human sociality, human tastes, human interests. That is to say, it explains also our basic psychology, how we perceive the world, the values that we have in the world. An example of that would be a fear of snakes. Fear of snakes is worldwide. Fear of snakes is something which is of course, not even limited to human beings. Here in New Zealand, we actually have no snakes. This is a snake-free country, so to speak. If you're afraid of snakes, it's a great place to actually go out walking in the bush. But outside my office window, I'm on an upper story of a building at the university. What we have are pigeons, European pigeons, brought into this country many years ago, which have reproduced as they have in European cities. So we've got pigeons around, and these pigeons come up and want to stay on my window. Well, they're very dirty, and I can't even open the window because this dust from pigeon droppings would blow in the window. What I've done is put rubber snakes on the windowsill. And this scares off the pigeon. Unfortunately, they just go to other people's windows. But, you know.
They're imported pigeons, so they know about snakes, I guess.
They know about snakes intuitively. They know about snakes innately, even though there are no local snakes. They're not part of the local culture, so to speak. Now, that's an example of an innate adaptation. Our liking for sweet and fat, our liking for sex, our liking for each other in some ways also has to do with natural selection. It has to do with basic elements of how we perceive the world, basic elements of our psychology. That's natural selection.
You talk about sexual selection.
Yeah, sexual selection, of course, is the other half of Darwin's great theory of evolution. And though, you know, natural selection is taught in schools and is considered very important, a lot of people don't realize that Darwin also had another great problem that was explained by an evolutionary process, and he's the one who gave us the great clear view of what that evolutionary process is. It's sexual selection. If the point is that natural selection can explain fingernails, our hair, our homeostasis in our bodies in terms of temperature regulation. Sexual selection can explain things which in nature seem actually against natural selection, that are exuberant, over the top. Bird feathers of these incredible colors. The peacock's tail with its enormous range of color and the size of it actually goes against natural selection. Peacocks stand a lesser chance of survival in the wild, growing this huge tail behind them. They can't outrun tigers and so forth. They can't fly well because of the tail. So that goes against natural selection. How do you explain it? Well, you explain it by sexual selection. The peacock's tail is a product of peahen choices. It's the ladies who are choosing to mate with the males with the biggest, most gorgeous peacock tails. And that gets going by actually mate choice, female mate choice in the case of the peacock. But, of course, what they give us is this huge range of coloration in particularly male birds across the world. And that can be extended into many other areas of evolution, including human evolution, where I argue in the book sexual selection, selecting each other in terms of the ability to use language, the ability to make jokes, in terms of wit, charm, storytelling, artistic abilities in a general sense, not high artistic abilities in the sense that we're talking about Beethoven or Mozart or Shakespeare here. We're just talking about the way in which people, human beings, particularly, I'm sure, after the invention of language, would choose articulate, interesting mates. Males were doing this with females. Females were doing this with males. That, I think, explains the great increase in size in the human brain in the Pleistocene, and it goes a long way to explaining our interest in the complexity and expressive capabilities of the arts.
I think you're saying that sexual selection, as distinct from natural selection, sexual selection is about beauty. It's about aesthetics. And I can certainly see the connection with art there. Are there other connections, though? I mean, it doesn't strike me that natural selection and what it does necessarily translates into a theory that would explain art and the history of art.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that it's hard to be completely clear on this, but when we're talking about beauty, we're talking about anything that actually we have innately, which would have, in the Pleistocene, increased our survival. So we talked earlier about landscapes. Those landscapes, to us, are heartbreakingly beautiful. That's an emotional reaction which, if we had that emotional reaction in the Pleistocene, we and our fellows would have stood a better chance of survival. Remember that the human history, I should add at this point, that human history and human prehistory in evolution includes a huge range of variously heritable proclivities, capacities, and interests. But by and large, the things that we have today as part of the makeup of the human personality, the inherited makeup of the human personality, are things that had survival value.
I think another way of doing this might be to look at a chapter which I found to be the very core of the book, and indeed it is, I think, in the very center of the book, and it's a chapter on storytelling, in fact. tell us what storytelling does for us as human beings, what practical use it has.
Well, storytelling would be an extension of imagination. In the first place, just leaving fictions aside, the ability that human beings have to use their imagination to wonder, where did I leave the car keys? Oh, gosh, did I meet that person last week or when was it? Or to map out what you're going to do next week, to strategize, to imagine states of affairs that are not in the here and present. The ability to do that would have been extremely powerfully survival-enhancing in the Pleistocene. But human beings go beyond that, because human beings don't simply think in terms of alternative scenarios that would apply to me here and now. And my, in other words, whether there's food on the other side of the mountain or whether this tree had berries last year, that sort of thing would have been valuable. But human beings have a natural, spontaneous interest in fictions. Now, if you think about that, it's really kind of weird. So I suppose back in the Pleistocene, we learned to use stone tools, and human beings produced stone tools. There was no benefit from learning how to produce dull tools. You wanted to produce sharp adzes and useful adzes. In a way, our interest in fiction is rather curious. We should have evolved to be interested, perhaps, in nothing but true stories. So we'd be interested in truth, and we distinguish that from lying, and we distinguish it from untruth in various ways, but truth would be what we'd be interested in. As it turns out, we evolved to be highly interested in fictions, that is to say, in made-up stories, in make-believe. And you see this, by the way, with small children who naturally, from a very early age, are involved in make-believe and stories. They're down there in the sandbox, and they've got their little toys that they're playing with, and they're making up stories spontaneously. And they're doing this with a sophistication, a spontaneous sophistication that simply can't be explained by cultural conditioning. Alan Leslie is a psychologist who studied this, and here's his description of a child's tea party, which I think is really worth paying attention to. He says, children pretend tea out of an empty teapot into several cups. And of course, they're careful to align the teapot with the cup, because in the pretend world of the tea party, liquids fall down just like they do in the real world, even though there's no liquid in the pot. Then an experimenter, an adult psychologist, as I say, playing with the child, knocks over one of the cups, laments the fact that the pretend tea is spilled all over the table, and asks the child to refill the empty cup. Now, three-year-olds faced with the situation, that is to say, with two actually empty cups, only one of which is also pretend empty, don't make mistakes and pretend fill only the pretend empty one, not the actually empty one that is still pretend full. This is a virtuoso performance of distinguishing what is real and what is not in all situations of pretense. The child's cognitive system can handle the non-actual assumption of the situation and run inferences of the intuitive ontology, that is to say, as to whether there's tea in this pretend tea in this cup and not in the other, in the imagined context, and distinguish it from a real context. And this kind of sophistication has to involve some kind of an innate adaptation. You cannot teach that to a child who doesn't understand it in the first place.
Now, I understand how amazing that is, that a three-year-old can make those kinds of distinctions. I'm not sure, though, what good it might do them for survival.
I think the answer is that it would have had survival value, because it would have allowed people to run sort of, that storytelling would have allowed in the Pleistocene people to run all sorts of scenarios, of strategies, to talk about how you deal with lions, how you deal with hunting, in ways that the person understands or make-believe, and then when they go to the real world, they're able to act more effectively in the real world. I mean, a lot of us have learned an awful lot from going to movies and from reading stories all our lives, from turning on fictions on television. I mean, I say in the book that I don't think I've ever read a history of Russia. And yet I realized, gosh, I think I know a lot about the Russian social system in the 19th century, the serf system,
Tolstoy,
how people
Dostoevsky.
Addressed each other. I've got it all from Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Chekhov, and everything else. I mean, that's what Gogol is good for. That's what storytelling is good for. It actually broadens our horizons and has survival value in the Pleistocene.
That's Dennis Dutton, critic, philosopher of art, editor, and teacher. He's the author of The Art Instinct, Beauty, Pleasure, and Human Evolution. And he's my guest today on Ideas. Using the insights of evolutionary psychology, Dennis Dutton has come to believe that art and storytelling are adaptations that have helped us to survive. All this art, this image-making, comes with a ready supply of emotion. I asked Dennis Dutton why art was so heavily invested with feeling. What purpose does emotion serve in terms of art and human evolution?
Well, that's a very good question. In the third chapter of the book, I give these 10 characteristics of the arts worldwide, and two of them involve emotion, and they're extremely important. Now, I can describe them, but I don't have all the answers, Paul. I mean, I can't really tell you absolutely why I think they are there. I mean, one thing to be said about emotion in the first place is that our emotional reactions in general, where they are innate, have to do somehow with survival. I mean, emotions of fear, emotions that would involve uneasiness, of anger. We have these emotions because they had survival value in their way in the Pleistocene. So the fact that works of art give us a sense of emotion are two things about them: saturated with emotion. You listen to the Brahms Fourth Symphony, and, you know, from the very first bars of these great descending notes, you are sort of put in an emotional world. Emotion doesn't happen later on or happen in the peaks. The curtain goes up on a play by Chekhov, and somebody will say something, you know, I don't know, completely inconsequential. There's two women on the stage. One says, it stopped snowing. I've just made that up. It's not Chekhov.
It sounds like Chekhov to me.
It does sound like Chekhov, doesn't it? And immediately, you're in an emotional world. Now, I find this one of the most curious and interesting things about the arts. The arts don't incite promotion or provoke emotion. I mean, World Cup soccer matches do that, and, you know, political campaigns and can incite or provoke emotion. But they somehow are saturated with it, and they express it. And we love the expression of emotion in the arts. Now, why that is a big question. I think part of it has to do with the status of the arts as communicative devices. That is to say, on the one hand, we're able to see them as make-believe objects. The piece of music is a make-believe object. The story is make-believe. On the other hand, they are a way to get into the mind of the artist. We are obsessed, I think, by getting into the minds of artists. Just yesterday, I happened to come on a quotation by the novelist David Foster Wallace, who recently committed suicide, who told Laura Miller, a writer for Salon magazine on the web, that for me, reading fiction, or he said that for him, reading fiction made him feel unalone, intellectually, emotionally, spiritually, he wrote. I feel human and unalone, and I'm in that deep, significant conversation with another consciousness. Now, I think that is important. That is to say, when you read Jane Austen or listen to Beethoven, when you hear Stravinsky, go to hear a pianist, the great Glenn Gould, whom I heard twice in my life, including his last recital in Los Angeles, you have a sense, even though Gould would be made uncomfortable by this, I know, you have a sense of being in contact with another human mind. I think Wallace caught that perfectly. I feel unalone when I read great fiction. You have a sense not of being manipulated, of being incited, but looking into another mind. Now, I argue in the book that that's part of the adaptive value of the arts, that they came into being because they were in a sense, performances. I mean, they were dance performances in the Pleistocene and the Upper Paleolithic. They were poetic performances. They were joke-making. They were paintings on the walls of caves, carvings. They involved hairstyling. They involved what would have been Pleistocene fashion. I mean, I can tell you that this was done in the late Pleistocene, all of these things I'm talking about. The only thing, of course, we have are a few carvings and some cave paintings. But there was a much richer life that was going on. And I think the arts evolved as a way for us to respond appreciatively to other human beings. That is to say, and I think those involved the kind of choices that women and men were making about who to go to bed with, who to mate with, who to hang out with in the Pleistocene. In fact, Jeffrey Miller, who's written about sexual selection, has said that he thinks the great metaphor for sexual selection and this sense of communion with another mind in the Pleistocene, he's talking about language in general, I'm talking about the arts. He said the human mind evolved in the Pleistocene quite beyond a simple survival mechanism. It evolved to be a overpowered, hyped up Pleistocene home entertainment system that could tell stories and make up jokes and recount anecdotes and make up totally fantastic stories and do it just to entertain other human beings. And that's where the growth of the human mind and human culture comes from. It comes from that ability. None of this denies the importance of culture. But culture is caused by those proclivities. Culture is not the thing that causes us our interest in fantasy. Our interest in fantasy and fiction and make-believe is deeper than culture. Culture is actually allows us to make it communicable to each other.
There's a character who pops up in the book, and I must say I was completely surprised to find him in this context, and I would never have put him there until you did, and I want you now to describe to our listeners why you did. This is Immanuel Kant, who you turn into almost a sort of proto-evolutionary philosopher. I'm not sure he would like that characterization of himself either, but you like his idea of seeing art as engaged but also disinterested at the same time. That's a very important distinction.
A very important distinction. And I do think that Kant is the greatest modern aesthetic thinker. The greatest ancient aesthetic thinker is Aristotle in the Poetics. And you can see it in Aristotle's Naturalism when Aristotle is talking about how children imitate the adults and where the arts come from. I mean, he's just Aristotle, I think, would have been completely on side with this. And I think Kant would have been too. Kant actually, in his Third Critique, his last great work of the three critiques that he wrote, the first one dealing with epistemology and metaphysics, the second one having to do with ethical theory, and the third one having to do with art and the aesthetic life. Kant saw the most important concept to understand the arts as disinterestedness. We're not uninterested in the arts. We're terribly interested, but we are able to stand back and appreciate them strictly as what he would have called semblances, or what Schiller called semblances, what Kant treated as though they have no direct practical value, but rather we see them as presentations. We see them simply as spectacles. You know, the work of art in this Kantian sense doesn't happen in the world, even. It doesn't happen there on the floor of the museum. That screen in the movie theater is actually just a white wall you're looking at for that whole afternoon. Where it happens is it happens in the human mind. That's where the intensity of intellectual experience combines with emotional experience in ways that make art. And Kant understood that, and I think Kant, who had a great respect for non-European arts, I mean, Kant actually wrote about the facial tattooing of the Maori. This is in 1791 in that book, because he read Cook's voyages and other descriptions of travels around the world. He talks about the Iroquois. He talks about the Carib Indians. Kant had a huge respect for all sorts of human expressions around the world. He wasn't some kind of an 18th century, xenophobe who was only interested in his German view of the world. He was a real cosmopolitan thinker, and I love him for that. And I love him for this idea of disinterestedness, that all arts are, in a sense, make-believe.
I'll certainly buy the connection to art and the disinterestedness. What I'm worried about, I guess, is would Kant see himself as a pre-Darwinian? Where does he fit into the theory of evolution?
Well, he's writing 70 years before The Origin of Species. So, yes, he's not really a Darwinian, but he was certainly a great naturalist. I don't think that Kant would have had any problem with Darwin had he lived 100 years later. He was interested in naturalistic explanations of the natural world, including human beings. Of course, he thought that the human mind and human consciousness somehow was noumenal, was beyond what we could explain phenomenally in the natural world. I mean, he saw it as somehow in a way that was logically behind everything that we see. But nevertheless, I think that he would have been pro-Darwinian. As even many religious believers are. I mean, the denial of Darwin is really only comes from two areas so far as we go into the 21st century. It's from Christian and increasingly Muslim fundamentalists who are creationists, and it also comes out of the post-structuralist English department, humanities department, believers in post-structuralism. They're heavily into Darwin denial as well. I think Darwin really has the best set of ideas to explain something like the prehistory and the history of the arts of anybody.
I have no trouble understanding the connection you're making between Kant and the arts, I suppose. But what I need to know is how Kant might relate to, I guess, the evolutionary argument you're making. I guess I'm asking, how does disinterested contemplation, something you say Kant was good at understanding in terms of our appreciation of the arts, how does that help us survive? How is it an evolutionary advantage?
Well, I think it's just part of the high human intelligence that we have, that we're able to stand back from reality and objectively think about it. I have this list of characteristics of the arts in the book, and perhaps the most important on that entire list is imaginative experience. That is to say, the arts happen in the theater of the mind. This would have had, I think, survival value because it would have allowed us to think independently of direct needs. If you think about other animals, they're kind of directly responding to this threat or that opportunity, whether it's food or another member of the same species or a predator. They're directly responding all the time. We're the species that thinks outside the immediate moment, that thinks, and with the arts, we can think in ways that are just unimaginably, or in fact they are imaginably, imaginably beyond the present moment. So that's why I think, you know, you could say whether you're talking about a marble carving of a realistically that represents an animal as a work of sculptural art, of course it's an imaginative object. The costume dance by firelight with this intense unity of purpose I'm reading here possesses an imaginative element quite beyond the group exercise of factory workers. This is what Kant meant by presentation and by the contemplation of the beautiful. It takes us beyond, it takes us into a make-believe world in the theater of the mind that is beyond just our immediate interests. And then when you add to that everything else that's on the list, the direct pleasure, our enjoyment of skill and virtuosity, I mean, that's something about which I think modern aestheticians have had very little to say. Most people, when it comes to the arts, love them because they are skill displays. They love that pianist. They love the piano, the artists. And people will say, I mean, it may be embarrassing to modernists and to people who fancy that they have some kind of elite taste, but people will go through a museum and they'll say, gosh, you know, he painted every hair. They'll say after a piano recital, you know, she never missed a note. People love to talk about manual use of hands in art and use of words. That's why, by the way, I think handmade is an item of personal, of perpetual, eternal interest to people in the arts. That is to say, handmade always has it over machine-made, because we're interested in what human hands can make. But skill and virtuosity, the skill of a composer in creating a piece of music, the skill of a pianist in realizing it in front of us, is something that is of great value to us in the arts. And as I say, I think insufficiently talked about. Things are made in styles. The works of art tend to represent. I mean, this is something that Aristotle noticed, that we love imitations and representations of things. And we're talking here about pictures. We're talking about fictional representations. If you just think for a second of, for example, a child's dollhouse, and go down and look carefully into the kitchen of that doll's house and look at that little table with its chairs around it. And on the table are tiny goblets and little plates and a tiny little oranges in a bowl and a little ham and maybe a tiny cherry pie with a lattice crust on it. This sort of thing gives delight to human beings. They don't have to learn it from their culture. People, even adults, are delighted by this kind of miniaturization, this kind of representation. We love pictures, we love movies, we love television for this reason. As Aristotle said, we love representation. Of course, we love novelty and creativity as well. We like occasionally to be shocked. We like a lot of the time to be shocked by fictions, sometimes by fictions which might intellectually tax our abilities. Think of Finnegan's Wake. Think of some of the great modernist works. Think of The Rite of Spring. I mean, they, you know, famously rioted at the first performance of The Rite of Spring. People got used to it. Maybe some later modernist experiments people won't be getting used to. I argue in the book that, for example, Schoenberg, I certainly recognize him to be a very fine composer, that I don't think that atonality has much future in music because of the way people perceive sounds. Those are evolved ways that we have of perceiving pitch tones in terms of their ability to express emotion, and you can't get that out of atonal music, which is why I think it has no future.
That's well, I was going to ask actually whether that was perhaps not true across the arts, all the arts. I mean, one can talk about the novel, for example. You're looking for the novel to give us information or to give us options for things we could do, which sure would be useful to us in terms of survival. But what about plotless novels, novels that don't have much information, don't really make a lot of sense? Are they very useful or useful at all in the way you're talking
They're
about?
Certainly novel. They're creative. They can have, whether it's Pinter or Kafka, they can have an emotional tone. They can be great intellectual challenges, and I think intellectual challenging us intellectually is part of what the arts ought to do. It's not the whole story. I think intellectual challenges maybe have been a bit overrated by academics and by some modernists, because people also want out of the arts some kind of emotional communion with an artist, and you don't always get that from arid modernist experiments. But nevertheless, this all has a place in the arts. I'm not trying to say, oh, artists should do this or shouldn't do that. But I am saying, to use that example of mine, I am saying that I don't think that atonality is going to fly very far in the history of music. Where music is going, I have no idea. But I don't think it's going down a track of atonality. People actually find it fairly excruciating.
Okay, another chapter I want you to focus on, because it was fascinating to me, is the chapter on forgeries. It's amazing. Why does it matter whether something is real or fake or a reproduction? What's the difference between each of those things in its purpose or its use to us in survival terms?
I suppose I've been, should we say, irritated or provoked by this question through the whole of my academic life as a philosopher who specializes in the philosophy of art. I think the Darwinian approach actually gives you something resembling a real solution to the problem. And it goes like this, that what we have with a work of art is what the Darwinians would call, in some sense, in addition to everything I've talked about, the emotions, representation, virtuosity, all of that, I mean, that's part of the picture. What we have is a Darwinian fitness signal. That is to say, we are very interested in the work of art in terms of who did it, where, and when. Now, you can say in some cultures, for example, small tribal cultures like New Guinea, where I've done work, I've been on the Sepik River and have studied carving with carvers on the Sepik River in New Guinea. People don't sign things, number one, because, you know, until recently, and still with many of them, they don't have any writing at all. They can't read writing, so they don't sign carvings. In a small tribal culture, everybody knows everybody who made everything anyway, so you don't have to sign it. But that doesn't mean that people aren't very interested in who made what and the qualities of the made object. That is to say, they're interested in artistic achievement. At the same time, we also view works of art in this disinterested way that Kant described them, in this make-believe way, as somehow set off, decoupled from the rest of the world. So you have a tension between two ways of looking at art. In one sense, you're very interested in who made it, whether it shows skill, whether it shows virtuosity, whether it shows emotional expressivity, whether we admire it, a person who made it for what it is. On the other hand, we have in conflict with that the idea that the work of art ought to be seen as a make-believe object. Well, once you see that you actually have what the Darwinians might, what some of them would call two modules here, which are in conflict with each other, then you see why forgery is an eternal problem. Of course, in the case of art forgery, then we add to that the fact that that paintings also can be worth a hell of a lot of money. So when they turn out to be a forgery, not only do we feel cheated aesthetically somehow, but the object is worth a lot less. What you have then are people saying, well, isn't it all just a matter of money? No, it's not just a matter of money. It's not, I mean, it doesn't make any difference to me in terms of my pocketbook whether the Van Meegeren forgeries of Vermeer are real Vermeers, but it does make a real important difference to my aesthetic response to those paintings made in the 1930s with Vermeer signed at the bottom, that they actually are forgeries and not the work of a 17th century artist. And I think that, you know, it seems to me that if we understand that the work of art is somehow comes across time and we are in communion with the mind of another person, I think of an extremely strong personality like Beethoven, that we have a sense of the wonder of the mind of Shakespeare, even of Homer, although it's pretty remote in the case of Homer. You read the Odyssey, nevertheless, and you have the sense that somebody with a real sense of human values has put these images and these ideas and this narrative together. To read Jane Austen and have a sense that you are actually communing with the intense wit and perceptiveness and skill and genius of this woman is part of the experience. That's why we care whether it's faked or not. And in that respect, it's no different than caring whether somebody won the marathon in New York by taking the subway rather than running all the way to the finish. You know, it makes a difference to us, and it should make a difference to us. The book defends the idea that we ought to care whether something's a forgery or not, and this has nothing to do with money. It has to do with a Pleistocene adaptation for caring about the mind and the personality of the artist.
On Ideas, you've been listening to the philosopher, teacher, and critic, Dennis Dutton, author of The Art Instinct, Beauty, Pleasure, and Human Evolution. It's published by the Bloomsbury Press and is distributed in Canada by Penguin. The producer for Ideas was Richard Handler. Technical operations by Dave Field and Greg Fleet. Thanks to Hamish Stoke of Radio New Zealand in Christchurch. If you'd like to learn more about upcoming Ideas programs and podcasts, sign up for our weekly online newsletter. Just go to our website at cbc.ca/ideas and follow the links. The executive producer of Ideas is Bernie Lucht, and I'm Paul Kennedy.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.